Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back this Thanksgiving long weekend for our usual weekly market recap featuring, as usual, Lance Roberts. Lance, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Same to you. Your pants feeling a little bit tighter today?
I actually did okay. I got up this morning, went for a 5 mile run, so I'm good.
All right. Good for you. I got up and had to drive my wife to the airport and back. So I'm a little bit behind you here. So I'm resisting the urge to let the belt out a notch here. But that's what Thanksgiving's for. It's a little bit of overindulgence and hopefully just enough to disgust us to get back onto the straight and narrow afterwards.
Well, so my big thing was getting everybody. So we had like 22 people in our house. And we got everybody to take the leftovers on with them. So we have no leftovers left. So
we went to our in-laws last night and everybody brought way too much. And so my in-laws were just, you know, pushing all the leftovers on us. And yeah. I managed to do the same, escape with the minimum amount of the least destructive foods that were in there.
Exactly.
But anyways, to everybody watching, hope you guys had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Something that we're hugely grateful for on this channel is all your guys' participation and support. So really wishing everybody had the best of family, food, and friends. We appreciate you spending your long Thanksgiving weekend watching this weekly market recap as well. And it was, you know, somewhat of a truncated week, right? Markets were closed yesterday, only open for a couple hours today. That said, the markets, you know, we're able to eke out some gains this week. So we're above 4,000 again. I'll let you make any commentary on any, you know, notable action that you saw this week. But really quickly, I'm beginning to see more and more articles written about what you have been saying could happen, which is, hey, folks, there could be a real rally going into the end of the year here. And an article just out recently today, I think, from Fundstrat, which notable bull Tom Lee is the head researcher for. He's one of these guys you see on CNBC all the time. But he is calling for a 1982 style rally to the end of the year where we could get the S&P up to like 44, 4500. Yeah. I've seen a few other guys making calls like that. You're saying no? Okay.
Nah. I love Tom Lee. He comes up, he just pulls stuff out of his butt and to make these wild claims that generally never come true. You know, he's great when you're in the middle of a rip roaring bull market because stuff just goes up. So it's like, oh yeah, we're going to go to 5,000, you know, whatever. And the market goes up. So, you know, but he just comes up with these weird stuff. This is not, and I even wrote an article. If you go to realinvestmentadvice.com, I wrote an article called Paul Volcker, Why This Is Not 1982, which is all based on Tom Lee's call that the bear market is now behind us and we're off to the rip roaring races of another 1980 to 2000 secular bull market. Ain't the case, near the case.
Well, hold it there because I'm working up to another article of yours here and then I'm just gonna let you run. Whether or not we get a Tom Lee style, you know, massive melt up here. And you know, look, there are folks that have said, we're coming off of the largest bull market in history, you know, and some measure that by, you know, decades, right? And they say that most bull markets don't end with a whimper. They end with some massive blow off spike, right? I'm not saying that's going to happen this time, but that's an argument these folks make. I was just interviewing Jim Rogers and he said, yeah, we could see some sort of rally from here. In Jim's words, he calls it the last rally. Yeah. Which is, you know, he's predicting the biggest bear market of his lifetime and the biggest recession of his lifetime. And he's basically saying, if we get this thing, use it as your chance to step off at these higher prices, because this is the last train out right before things get bad. Now, I want to connect this to an article written by a smart guy named Lance Roberts that's titled More Bearish Market Action Before the Bull Can Run. So I'm going to let you kind of go off here and say whatever you want. But real quick, as you explain this, does that title mean a more bearish market action before the bull can run? Does that mean this bear market has more room to go before it's over? Or are you saying we've got to see something negative in the short term to get an end of year rally?
No. So, you know, as you and I have been talking about for a while is, you know, the setup right now is for a rally to year end. And again, we laid out probably 5 weeks ago now that we start talking about The market was extremely oversold, super negative bearish sentiment. The buyback window was opening back up. So we had $5 billion a day in stock buybacks coming back in. We've got year-end portfolio rebalancing. So this rally that we've had is very coincident with kind of the premise that we laid out, you know, 4 or 5 weeks ago. We said, hey, use this rally to sell into. And, you know, what's important about the rally and why, you know, Tom Lee's going to be wrong is the rally's going as we expected. And now you're getting everybody to be bullish, which is exactly what you want to see. So before right. we had super negative bearish sentiment, which was the perfect setup for a rally. Now you're getting everybody to be bullish. And this is suggestive that we're probably closer to the end of this rally than not. And now, as I think I laid this out maybe last week or the week before, going into the last couple of months. So this rally this week, we didn't go anywhere. We've been in a consolidation range now for the last 3 weeks. We've just been traveling sideways. We're at the top end of this little range that we've been bouncing back and forth in. And the action this week, we said, hey, this market could do anything this week. Nobody was around. All the professional traders, they're off in the Hamptons right now for the Thanksgiving holidays. It's just the inmates running the asylum at the moment. So low volume market movements, they don't really mean much. We could have a bit more rally next week just because everybody gets excited coming back. The market's done okay and didn't fall apart. So everybody's going to get excited, potentially make a little run up here to 4,100-ish, somewhere around there, be very possible. But then we've got the first 2 weeks of December. Now, there's a lot of mutual funds. 25% of mutual funds have their year ends in December versus 5% in November. So 25% of mutual funds are going to have to make their annual distributions for capital gains if they have any, interest income and dividend income, which they do have. So they'll have to sell some stuff to make those distributions. And then they're going to need to rebalance their portfolio, which means potentially selling energy because that's the one sector that's done really well this year. So if they've had an exposure to energy, it's out of balance in terms of the portfolio. So they'll have to sell energy to buy stuff that's been beaten up, consumer discretionary, technology, those type of stocks. Those will get bought back up into the portfolio to rebalance the weights within the model, fixed income as well. And that'll set up that kind of, so a couple of weeks of volatility, maybe a bit of a sell-off here, maybe retest the 100-day moving average, maybe even retest the 50-day moving average. Is possible on a bit of a pullback. And then you get a rally in the year end, the last couple of weeks of the year, that Santa Claus rally, because that's where all these mutual funds have to rebalance and portfolio dress for the end of the year reporting. So they've got to make sure and have all the right stocks. So they may be selling some stuff on their books and buying some stuff to rebalance. But by the end of the year, they better have all the right energy names, all the right tech names, whatever it is, that their quarter four report goes out on. That's what they need to show to investors. They may buy it the last day of the year, but it's got to be on the books. So that typically gives you that Santa Claus rally into the end of the year. Now, once we get into next year, the reason I'm saying more bearish action next year is that we still have to compensate for weaker economic growth, right? We've got the Fed has been hiking rates aggressively. And it was interesting, the FOMC minutes this on Wednesday, which kind of sparked that Wednesday rally. The bulls jumped in on it because they thought it was dovish because there was language that suggested the Fed is going to slow the pace of rate hikes. What they overlooked is that the Fed may actually hike rates more. So instead of stopping at 5%, they're going to potentially go to 5.25%. So they may be slowing down the pace of rate hikes, but that is not a pivot. That is not a transition. That is not a pause of monetary policy. They're still tightening interest rates, which have not been factored into the economy. That'll happen next year. Markets have to reprice lower. So we get one more leg lower in the markets to reprice for all these rate hikes or recession, whatever we're going to have next year. And again, you know, there's one thing that we talked about earlier this week on our radio show, is that you have to give the possibility of a no recession scenario a bit of credence. Could it happen? Possibly. Is it likely to happen? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But you've got to at least leave a sliver of your portfolio allocation there to say, if we don't have a recession, then, you know, these stocks are going to perform well. So I need to have at least some exposure there. the odds on bet are that we're going to have a recession. The problem with that call is that everybody thinks we're going to have a recession. And as Bob Farrell once said, when everybody thinks one thing, something else tends to happen. So, you know, I would like to see more people like Tom Lee coming out. We're starting to see a bit more of this. We're starting to see a bit more of a call of the no recession or very soft landing scenario. Goldman Sachs out last week talking about, you know, no recession in 2023. Awesome. We need a lot more of that. We need a lot more Tom Lee's coming out saying, hey, this market's going to go to 4,500 or 5,000, be a new highs before you know it. We need more of that talk if we're going to finish up this bear market next year and get it behind us and over with.
All right. So the more bullish champions you see entering and starting to kind of crow about how great things are going to be, that gives you more confidence in the bear side of the story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always, look, markets are always contrarian. So, you know, if everybody's on one side of the boat, generally that's not what turns out to be the case. So,
yeah. All right. Let me just mention two charts here from your article, and then feel free to comment any way you like in them. But I'll put them up side by side here. There's the Monetary Policy Conditions Index versus the S&P 500 annual percent change. And then there's one of the Monetary Policy Conditions Index versus the S&P 500 index earnings. And in both of them, you basically see the trajectory. You've got the conditions one here inverted, but yeah. You can see the trajectory on both is sort of plunging down right now.
Right. So actually the Monetary Conditions Index, it measures the dollar, the Fed funds rate, the 10-year treasury rate, and inflation. And that is those are the factors that impact households, the economy the most, right? So the dollar, strong dollar impacts corporate earnings, which are 40, you know, and corporate sales, which is 40% of overall corporate sales. So a strong dollar has a big impact on slowing economic activity. The Fed controls the short end of the curve. So higher interest rates obviously quells demand on the consumption front by raising interest rates on credit cards and variable rate loans, those type of things, auto loans. The long end of the curve, that's the 10-year treasury rate and 30s. I mean, I use the 10-year, but you could throw the 30 in there as well. But that's your longer term financing, right? That's your corporate debt, that's your household mortgages, those type of things. Higher those rates go, the less activity that occurs. Obviously, we see what's going on with the housing markets now. And then, of course, inflation is the big driver, right? That just, you know, we're paying more dollars for less stuff, right? So consumers have to deal with that. So when you put all these into an index, what you get is this kind of monetary conditions of the economy, and just it tells you whether or not that's accommodative or not. When that index is very low, you have low inflation, low interest rates, you know, a weak dollar, that's obviously great for the economy, right? So everybody's financing and doing all kinds of stuff. Markets tend to be advancing in a bull market in that environment when you have very accommodative policy, when it's very tight. And right now you're at one of the tightest levels on that index's record. Obviously markets tend to not perform well, economic growth slows down. So if you invert it, and that's what I did in these two charts. So if you invert it, not surprisingly, there's a very high correlation between the annual rate of change in the S&P index and that monetary conditions index. And the reason you invert it is because it's a non-correlated graph, right? So if the monetary index is a very high level, that's, you know, stocks are declining, right? So they're inverted. So if you invert the index, you get a better view of the correlation is all. Obviously, the same thing occurs for earnings. And that what the Monetary Conditions Index is telling us right now is, again, the whole point of what we're saying is that, you know, the monetary conditions of the economy are not conducive to stronger earnings and stronger price appreciation in stocks right now. Stocks still have to accommodate for these tighter conditions in the markets. And that's why I'm suggesting that we've got some more work to do in order to align the market with earnings as we head into next year.
All right. All that makes sense. And just looking at the charts here, it seems like in general, the Monetary Conditions Index does seem to be a bit of a leading indicator of where S&P prices and earnings are headed.
Yeah, it's about 6 months.
Okay. And so just looking at some of these charts, particularly the earnings one, it looks like, you know, the earnings has got to play catch up to where the index is right now.
Yeah, that's what you expect. And see, here's the other problem with this rally. this is not what the Fed wants, right? So
right.
You remember that when market was rallying back in July and August, that was where Jerome Powell was at Jackson Hole, and he rewrote his entire speech 15 minutes before his speech and came out and said, hey, we're not only not going to stop hiking rates, we're going to hike more aggressively, because he had to get the stock market down, because as the market rallies, that reduces monetary tightness, right? So that makes monetary accommodations easier in the markets. And so this kind of rally we're having right now is actually working against what the Fed's trying to achieve by, you know, giving people a better boost of confidence and those type of things. So don't be surprised, you know, right now, and this was another takeaway from the FOMC meeting, is that they're going to slow, the Jerome Powell says, hey, we're going to slow, at some point, we will slow the pace of rate hikes. Everybody assumes that's December, that we're going to go to 50 basis points in December. That's probably right. But if I'm Jerome Powell right now, I've got a rally going on in the markets. If I want to smack the markets down here a bit, I hike 75 basis points in December. I don't think that's entirely off the table.
Right. Or you guide that right now they're expecting maybe, you know, a couple quarter points early next year. You say, hey, now it's going to be 50 in, you know, January.
Yeah.
All right. And not for nothing too, I'm just going to quickly put up a chart here of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. It's slight, but we are beginning to see quantitative tightening start to bite here. And I think I read that the Fed balance sheet contracted on a year-over-year basis last week for the first time since December of 2019. Right. So everybody that's been saying, hey, I keep hearing about quantitative tightening, but I'm not seeing anything. We now actually are beginning to see this. And as we've said, you know, Fed policy is, you know, it's like moving a tanker at sea, right? You know, you turn the wheel, but it takes a long while for the ship to stop moving in the direction it was moving in and then begin to start moving the other way. It looks like we're now beginning to see that direction shift.
Well, and again, you know, the big problem with the QT is that the Fed for the last few years have been buying mostly short-term bills. So they had a whole lot of really short maturities on their balance sheet. So when they talked about, so back in June, they started quantitative tightening and they ramped that up from 60 to 95 billion a month by August. But what that means is that as these bonds mature, if I have 95 billion of them mature, then those are coming off the balance sheet. But if I have 150 billion mature, I'm still buying bonds because I'm buying everything over that $95 billion mark. Right. The other side is they can't sell the mortgages because if you don't understand how mortgage did last week when you had Michael Leibowitz doing the bond seminar, did he talk about how mortgage backed bonds do have a prepayment speed on them?
No, we didn't get into that.
Okay. So when you have a mortgage-backed security, which you remember when the Fed does quantitative easing, they buy two types of bonds. They buy treasury bonds and they buy mortgage-backed securities. And a mortgage-backed security has what's called a prepayment speed to it. So in other words, Adam buys a house, he gets a 30-year mortgage. But the majority of people don't keep their house mortgaged for 30 years. The average person pays off their mortgage within 7 to 8 years. Either they pay it off or they sell their house and go buy something else. So when interest rates are very low, people are refinancing their mortgage as interest rates come down. So that prepayment speed is very fast. So in other words, I may put out a 30-year mortgage, but it's paying off every 2 years, right? And so as these mortgage-backed bonds are maturing, they're getting replaced on balance sheets and these type of things. Well, the problem for the Fed right now is because they drove interest rates to 7%, nobody's refinancing. So those prepayment speeds have now gone from 5, 6, 7 years to 30 years. So they're having and so if you look at what's happening in the balance sheet, they're not reducing their mortgage-backed securities because all those prepayment speeds ran out to 30 years. So they've just been rolling off treasuries up to this point. But if they're going to reduce their balance sheet, they're going to have to start hitting the mortgages as well next year, which may become a bigger problem for the mortgage market as well.
That's a great point. I'm making an earmark to dig into that in a future podcast. Let me just read this one quick quote here from Goldman. This is just noting again the state of the current Fed balance sheet. For every $1 of US GDP, there are still 34 cents on the Fed balance sheet. Now, just before COVID hit, that number was only 22 cents. In the third quarter of 2008, it was just 6 cents. Yeah. Right. So it shows how much that the balance sheet has really ballooned relative to GDP. They even compared it to the end of World War II, which was the last time that we had a really high, you know, debt to GDP ratio in this country. And even then it was just 11 cents. Right. And yeah. Again, it's still currently at 34. So in Goldman's words, in other words, there's a lot more shrinkage to come. So, to me, Lance, that just sort of underscores your general sort of expectation of more bearish market action next year as this stuff really begins to bite, as Powell continues to hike, holds rates higher than longer, for at least as long as he can before something breaks. Of course, something breaks isn't bullish, that's bearish too, right? And we have all this tightening going on the balance sheet, the Fed's balance sheet at the same time. So again, you know, as you said, we need to reserve some potential out there for the soft landing, for the Fed to just stick it, right? Stick the landing perfectly. Probably not going to happen. But, you know, you have to be mindful of that. But, you know, for the general positioning of the portfolio, we got to play with where we think the probabilities lie.
Yeah. And most importantly, be willing to change your position. You know, one of the big problems that happens with people is they get kind of stuck into this.
Yeah, you get wedded.
Yeah. And when the facts change, you've got to change your portfolio. So, I mean, you know, we may be on this show one Friday and say, oh, this looks terrible. And the next Friday we're going, hey, bull market's back. We're in 100%, right? Because the Fed has cut QE or cut QT, they're back to QE and dropped rates to zero overnight. I mean, that could, I don't suspect that will happen. But my point is that when the facts change, we're going to have to change our outlook and change our positioning. And it could be very quick.
Yeah, well, so on that point, at the end of your article here about more bearish action likely needed before we can get bullish again, you end with 7 rules to navigate the final leg of a bearish market. Yeah. I'd love for you to just quickly summarize all of those if they're still fresh enough in your mind to do so. and I'll toss each one out to you so you know.
Well, I know it's really pretty easy. I mean, you know, the first thing is just to move slowly. You know, we've talked about before when managing your money, it's like a game of football, right? It's a game of inches, right? You don't come up to the line every time and throw a Hail Mary because you're going to lose the game doing that. I mean, it's more often, baseball is the same way, right? You win games by hitting singles, not trying to hit home runs. So just move slowly, and no matter what your view is or what you think your view is, say, okay, I want to be here, right? I want to have less exposure or more exposure, whatever. Like we've been doing over the last several weeks, it's just been, as this market's rallied, we've been slowly kind of just selling into the rally, reducing our exposure, just very slowly, little bits here and there. And we've got our portfolio down to pretty much where we want to be going into year end. So, and then that gives us the ability to have cash that we can start buying at some point, the things that we want to buy. And we'll do that slowly as well. So again, just you don't have to make big drastic changes. One of the big mistakes investors make is they go, well, I'm not happy with this. I'm going to throw everything out and start completely over. Yeah. And generally what happens is that whatever you throw out is what's about to start working and jump into what was working that no longer works. And this happens all the time, right?
And honestly, that's just pure reversion to the mean most of the time, right?
It is in psychology, yeah. Right? So the second thing is, of course, is to start, you know, looking at, okay, well, if I'm going to start selling stuff, right? You know, how do I start selling? And so start thinking about, you know, the laggards and the losers in your portfolio, the things that, you know, this is a great time of the year right now to look at those things that haven't been working and sell them, right? We get the tax loss for it. We'll do the tax loss harvesting for year end. It also kind of just gets the dead wood out of the portfolio. Adam, you and I have talked about gardening before, and there's a lot of similarities between gardening and portfolio management. So this is a good time to go weed the garden. If you don't weed your garden every now and then, what's going to happen is you'll wind up with a whole yard full of weeds and no garden. And, right. You know, and we do this, right? It's like, well, I'll sell this stock when it comes back. Well, that's fine, except eventually what you wind up with is a whole bunch of stocks you're hoping will come back and you've got nothing that's growing.
Right.
So, you know, sell the stuff that's not working. It's okay. It doesn't mean you're a loser. It doesn't mean that you're a terrible investor. It just means you bought something wrong and it didn't work out. So you sell it, move on. And here's the other thing. Just because you sell something, you're not in the club that says you can never buy it back again. I don't know what this is about people, but they'll sell ExxonMobil and I go, well, I can never buy, you know, I sold that stock, I lost money, I can never buy it again. No, you just bought it wrong. Now it's a good buy, go buy it back, put it back in your portfolio. So you're not outlawed from buying stuff back. That is completely okay. The other thing is to do more of what's working in your portfolio. So things that have been performing well, areas that are working well, but you've got to be careful with this. This is a good example of this year. You got to be careful going, okay, well, I'm just going to go stick everything into energy stocks, right? They've had a huge run this year. Oil prices have come down about 20% from their peak. Oil stocks have only come down about 5% because people are still chasing energy stocks. Eventually, energy stocks will catch up with oil prices. And I suspect that'll happen sooner than later. And again, going into the end of the year, we could see a good bit of selling in energy stocks just as mutual funds rebalance portfolios and have to sell that overweight position. So again, just be careful. Just when I say, you know, pile into stuff that's working, that doesn't mean go throw all your portfolio into one sector of the market. So, you know, just things that have been performing well, things that have a tendency to perform well, you know, or things that are setting up to perform well, that's where you want to add some money to. Outside of that, I'm trying to remember that there's another one right below.
Yeah. There's stop losses, which is the next
one. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Stop loss is most important thing. You know, when you're managing a portfolio, you know, have a level where there's a place where I'm selling it here, regardless of how I feel about it. Because again, it goes back to you just bought something wrong. You bought it too high, and it's correcting at some point. So there's a lot of views about stop losses, and none of them are wrong. I think you have to be careful though. So William O'Neill, who wrote the famous book about buying stocks, his view was an 8% stop loss. The problem that I have with an 8% stop loss, kind of, it's a stagnant percentage, right? It's always 8%. So wherever you are today, 8% below that, you're stopped out. The problem is in today's market, you can have a company that comes out and reports okay earnings, and the stock's down 15% in the morning. And so you get stopped out. And the next day it's up 10% because people realize that earnings weren't that really all that bad.
Right. Or even between the earnings release and then the CEO speaking, that can happen.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I don't like these stagnant percentages. And again, I think in this market that we're in now, because of all the algorithmic trading and high frequency trading and all this type of stuff, you've got to give a little bit more room to this and be a little bit more flexible. I prefer to use something that trends with the stock. So you can pick your measure, the 50-day moving average, the 200-day moving average. But be careful with that too. When let's say you use the 200-day moving average, and I actually did a video on this on my website about how to set stops. But when you break that initial break of the 200-day moving average, that doesn't mean sell your position right there. The reason is that stocks have a real interesting tendency of breaking a 200-day moving average as an example, and then the next day going right back up again. And people go, oh, well, see, stop losses don't work. I got whipsawed out of this position. Give the stock, once it breaks that stop loss, give it a day or two to see if it confirms that break. In other words, maybe it breaks below the 200-day moving average. The next day, it rallies to it and fails and then turns lower. That's a good stop.
So I just want to interject on here because there's one of the criticisms of stop losses today is this volatility you're talking about. And the thinking is you're almost guaranteeing yourself to sell the stock at whatever discount your stop loss is at. Right. Whether it's 8%. Oh, it's just going to get triggered and it may recover, but I've been kicked out. Right. I've been sold out. So I believe it was you who said this, which is you don't necessarily set stop losses, I'm sure you do in the portfolio, but you said you set more alerts, right? Where you get an alert that says, hey, it's now down 8%. And then a live person can come in and say, okay, I see it's down 8%. What do I want to do right now? Yes. Right. And it might be, okay, let's wait 24 hours and see what happens. Right. So it's not an automatic sell. At the end of the day, it's a person who's pushing the trigger to sell, but at least the alert is serving as your stop loss, you know, information. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's still the case. We don't actually put live stop losses out in the market. And there's a reason for that. We manage enough money that if we're putting out a stop loss on a position, it may be on 50, 60, 70,000 shares or 100,000 or 200,000 shares or something. And it's large enough to get the attention of all these algorithms that are out there. And what they will do is these algorithms will sub-penny the stock down to get to that stop loss, trigger the stop loss, and then start buying the shares back up, right? And so that's how you, a lot of that whipsaw comes in. So we our stops out live. That'll happen. So we have alerts set up. We have a whole system in our in-house of stop loss alerts. And when they triggered, we get alerted. But then we can go look at it and say, okay, hey, to your point, we broke the 200-day moving average. Let's give it a day, or let's give it the afternoon, or let's see what happens in a few minutes to see if we hold that. And a lot of times the stock will recover back above that and start going up the next day. If it follows through the next day, then we'll go ahead and trigger out and stop and do a stop loss on it. So, but again, that's just the way we do it. And again, there's no wrong way to do stop losses. The only wrong way to do stop losses is not do them at all.
Is to not use them, yeah. All right. And then there's a number six on yours. Seven we'll discuss later on, which is just, hey, if you feel confused about any of this stuff, consider working with a professional financial advisor. And I will beat that drum for you, Lance. You don't have to. But your last one here is really about, you know, having the conviction once a rally's on, given your outlook that you think the bear market's not done and it's going to come back in 2023, is to have the guts to sell into the rising prices of a rally, correct?
Yeah. Or to buy the bear market. Either way, I mean, it works both ways. You know, the thing is that you've got to do exactly what your gut tells you not to do. And that's the hard part about this is that, you know, the market's rallying. And look, I personally would just love this market to go back up to 5 or 6,000. It's my life is so much easier to manage money when stocks are going up, because I can just buy stuff and it goes up and everybody's right. happy. Nobody's complaining and, you know, clients are happy. And I love that. You know, but when stocks are down, you know, it's a much tougher environment. And then having to sell into these rallies, look, I'm human, right? I'm like, you know, but what if the rally keeps going up? I don't want to miss out on the upside, right? So, you know, there's part of me that I have to fight every day to sell into the rally just because it's human nature. But the same thing goes with at some point when this market is forming a bottom and everything feels terrible and you feel like the world's coming to an end, that's when you're going to have to muster up and start buying stocks. And that really goes to point seven, which is, this is very complicated. You know, it's not easy. And if you don't think you can do it, get somebody to help you. You know, you may pay, I hear a lot of people say, well, I don't want to pay a fee for an advisor. Well, if you're paying a fee to an advisor just to buy and hold a basket of ETFs, hey, I agree with you, you're wasting your money. But you know, if you're paying a fee to an advisor to manage the risks for you and to do the hard stuff, it's worth the fee you'll pay over time, whoever. Well,
yeah, absolutely. And look, most fees, you know, there's some variation, but it's around 1% or so if you're getting a good advisor. And when you consider the cost that most people have of making all of the bad decisions that are out there that most human investors make, I include myself in that group, which is why I work with a professional financial advisor. You're raising your own hand.
I make mistakes all the time.
Yeah, so. But that's, you know, and I say this all the time, so I won't beleaguer it. But like, you know, we given our evolutionary programming as Homo sapiens, investing is almost one of the hardest things for us to do, right? Because it pushes all sorts of emotional triggers for us that oftentimes force us to make the wrong choice at the wrong time. And working with an experienced professional financial advisor, well, they've got the institutionalized knowledge to counter all of that, right? And they help you come up with a plan that's data-driven, and they just take a lot of that emotion and uncertainty out of the program. So anyways, if at all, people, you feel like you're not, you know, 100% confident that you can execute all this, you know, perfectly, definitely consider working with a professional financial advisor. All right, I got a lot to go through here, Lance, so I'm going to move on to a few new topics. I'm also going to be surfacing a lot of visuals and free resources for folks here. There are two visuals I want to put up here. One, I just like to share, you know, the good things that happen to Wealthion as a channel when I can. I like to surface them because all the folks watching here have basically made this channel the success that it's becoming so far. So one, I just want to put up a chart here showing you the trajectory of Wealthion's traffic since it launched a year and a half ago. And folks, you'll see that it's been a great quarter for us. Right around the end of the summer, YouTube really started picking up on what we were doing here. And you can see the trajectory here and how much it's grown since then. And we just hit a record daily view all-time high just yesterday. And again, folks, that is all due to you, the viewers. I just want to make sure that you folks get a chance to see the results of your support. And I know everybody likes to feel like they're part of a winning team. It looks, folks, like Team Wealthion is winning for the time being. So that's exciting to be able to report. Secondly, Lance, you haven't seen this yet, so you're going to have to listen to my description, but everybody else should be able to see it. This was a meme on Twitter. I don't know if you've seen the memes of Vince McMahon. You know, he's the guy that started the WWF. But they have these memes of him where he's getting more and more excited. And at the end, his face is red. He's got laser eyes. And it's always some sort of progressive messaging in the meme that builds. Well, here somebody saw my tweet of the fact that we've got some great new guests coming up in December. We've got David Rosenberg coming back. Stephanie Pomboy is going to be guest hosting that interview with David. We then also have Felix Zuloff coming back to the program. Felix has been hands down the number one most asked for, I'd even say demanded for guest by the Wealthion audience, because when he came on early this year, his prediction pretty much nailed exactly the arc of what happened in 2022. So anyways, here's the meme, folks. It shows, Bill looking, mildly interested, where it says Wealthion podcast update. Hosted by Stephanie Pomboy, now he's getting pretty excited. With David Rosenberg, he's getting pretty ecstatic. And Felix Zuloff, and then the laser eyes come on. So folks, this just made my Thanksgiving holiday. What a great meme. And it is really completely, I couldn't be more excited to have these great guests coming back onto the program. And we've got some lines in the water, folks, for some even greater guests that hopefully might join us in 2023. And as I have news to announce on those, I'll definitely be announcing them here on this channel. Okay, so back to the markets and what might be happening from here. I just want to note, Lance, that the dollar has had its fifth consecutive week where it has declined, which is perhaps not unexpected given the immense run it had this year. But still, I mean, we've been saying for month after month after month, it's just been this inexorable juggernaut rise of the dollar. We're now seeing it cooling off here a bit.
Which is also why you're seeing the stocks rally.
And so my question here is this a material change, or do you think this is sort of lulling the market into complacency before the bear brings its claws back out again? You probably already answered that question earlier, but I just want to approach it from a dollar standpoint.
No, actually, there's two things to take a look at, I think, are really important to the survivability of this rally. The first is the dollar. The dollar is getting oversold. It's getting pretty deviated to the downside. And so the dollar's going to rally at some point here. It just, now the question is, does it rally to all-time highs and just keep going? Or does it rally, set a lower high and turn lower, and we start kind of working into a downtrend of the dollar? The dollar's not going to go straight down. It didn't go straight up either. So, it's going to rally here, and that's going to pull some of the wind out of the sails of this rally. And I think that could maybe even happen once we get into the beginning of December. The other thing to pay attention to is the volatility index. The volatility index is now back to 20. So why is that important? What the volatility index tells you is that basically nobody is worried about the markets, which is kind of hard to believe here. You had a very modest rally from the lows. 5 weeks ago, the world was coming to an end and everybody was in, stocking up on Spam and Beanie Weenies and thinking the world was all over. And now 5 weeks later, there's no fear in the markets, right? Volatility is back to 20. Stocks have done fairly well. But that's another good indicator to watch, because as you see that volatility index get down to these more depressed levels, that has been consistent with the peaks of the rally this year. One other thing is, we're seeing a lot more talk about the number of stocks above the 50 and the 200-day moving average. So I saw a couple articles out this week. Well, every time stocks got above the 200-day moving average like this, it's been the start of a new bull market. Well, not really, because back in July and August, we had stocks above their 200-day moving average about where we are right now, and that was the peak of the rally. You'll remember back in July and August, we had that 50% retracement of the Fibonacci fall, and everybody was like, that's a guaranteed sign the bull market's over. We're off to new highs, and then 2 months later, we're at new lows, right? So things don't always work out the way they think they are. And these are more indicators of bull markets, not bear markets. So you can have these, fairly extraordinary runs in a bearish market cycle. And they tend to fail, and you either retest lows or have a correction or set new lows. So again, I would be a little bit reticent getting too bullish right now. I think we've had a very nice run here. I would take profits. I would rebalance risk. And look, if the market just keeps going, if we do get above the 200-day moving average, come back, retest the 200-day moving average without breaking it, and then start to go up again, that's as good of a sign as you can get that the bull market's back and you want to have money invested in the markets, and we'll buy into it.
So let me ask you about that. So the other day in this program, someone was talking about how the S&P is sort of right at the 200 daily moving average. The 50 daily moving average is still a bit lower, but if we continue to rise from here or even just go sideways, that 50 moving average is going to come back up. And if it crosses the 200 daily moving average, I guess technically that's known as a golden cross.
Yep.
Tends to be looked at as a really powerful bullish signal.
Yep.
If that were to happen, what would your reaction be?
We would be long stocks and starting to become more bullish on stock on the markets. Because again, the 20 day has already crossed above the 50 day. The 50 day is rapidly approaching the 100 day. Long way to the 200 day. We got a long ways to go to get the 50 back above the 200 day. So, now.
So there's wood to chop there, as you're saying.
Yeah. So this, you've got a lot of work you have to go through here. But no, eventually the 50 will cross above the 200 day moving average. And they could do that simply by just this market kind of going sideways, right?
Yeah.
Bear markets don't have to go down. They can just go sideways. It's kind of frustrating when it does that because it takes longer, but it can happen. But no, these are the things that regard, and this is my point earlier about being careful with your view and being convicted to a particular outlook, because ultimately the markets are going to do what they're going to do, and they're going to price in all this bad news, and they're going to become more bullishly biased sooner than you think, potentially. I'm not saying this is absolutely the case, but you're going to be looking at something going, this has got to happen before this can happen. And that is not necessarily the case at all. So again, paying attention to price and moving averages and these type of things will give you good indicators that you at least, and this is the conversation Mike Leibowitz and I have almost every day, which is, okay, our thesis is, this is this weekend's newsletter that I'm getting ready to publish tomorrow at realinvestmentadvice.com, talking about no recession in 23. That's becoming the mainstream call. And more people are saying no recession in 23. And I'm sitting there looking at the data going, I don't see how you avoid a recession in 23.
Yeah, yeah.
But we've got to give, as I said earlier, we've got to give room to that possibility. And this is the conversation Mike and I have. It's like, okay, if we turn out to be wrong, what do we do? And where do we invest? And what do we buy? And those are the type of things those are the conversations we are having now going into the end of the year.
Good. And that's why I wanted to bring this up, which is, given that your primary thesis is that markets are still going to go down lower from here, looking at these daily moving averages, let's say we get the golden cross, that's going to be one of the things that might cause you to change your mind and say, hey, you know what? This might negate my thesis. I got to go, rejigger the portfolio as a result.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, great. That's a really good transition into our recession watch part of the program. Real quick before we do, just one last kind of big macro question for you is, again, thinking things that could kind of shake up people's assumptions right now, including your bearish one. Just curious to your thoughts on how big a factor you think China could be for the markets in 2023. And there's sort of two reasons I'm asking that question. One is, they just announced a new stimulus package of like $70 billion in liquidity to support the market there. And I think also at the same time, the People's Bank of China, they've reduced their reserve requirement ratio by 25 basis points. So they are now in an easing cycle there, trying to goose the economy. At the same time, the world is kind of sitting with bated breath, waiting for China to end its extreme COVID lockdown. If and when it does that, presumably at some point it will, that is going to give a short-term surge of growth to the global economy as you have this pent-up demand finally released, right? So how closely are you watching that? And is it something that if it were to happen, say, January of next year, you might say, oh, okay, wait a minute, I got to push things off a little bit here now?
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that could feed into this soft landing scenario. And again, we're watching that. You know, look, China has been the story for the last 12 years. You know, I remember back in 2008, it was China, China, China. China's mm-hmm. going to take over the world. They're going to be the world's largest economy. The U.S. is going into demise and so on. The stuff never really kind of works out the way people.
It doesn't, just not for nothing, that one point. I just want to make sure folks know. Yeah. One of the reasons why we got out of the 2008 global financial crisis as early as we did, even though it felt long and painful for a lot of folks, is because China did not have a lot of debt, and they took on a ton of debt in the ensuing decade. So they really did come to the global economy's rescue. And I'm just mentioning that not to contradict you, but to basically underscore, they can't do that this time around because their debt loads are so high this time.
Yeah, and that was one of the points I was going to get to.
Oh, well, there you go.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, there are some differences. And yes, you know, look, China is a major economic trading partner to the U.S. We buy a lot of crap from China. You know, Trump may have, you know, had his thing with China, but, you know, iPhones to cars to, you know, you name it, just we manufacture so much of our stuff in China because of cheap labor. Now we're friendshoring, so we are moving some of that, you know, to other countries of low cost labor.
Some,
but still China's a major player in this. So yeah, you can't dismiss the impact of, you know, credit easing by China, more liquidity by China, and economic demand boost. If they reopen their economy, that's certainly going to feed into, you know, our system. So we could see, you know, a couple of quarters of an uptick in economic activity. You know, but sustainability, I think, is going to be the longer term issue, you know, for the economy. Because again, you know, these are kind of one-off events. You know, we have a hurricane, as an example, comes through, destroys, you know, $5 billion worth of stuff, and we have to rebuild it. So we get this little temporary boost of economic activity for a couple of quarters. But then the overall economic activity comes back home to roost. So the one thing that, you know, yes, to your point, you know, if China did a whole bunch of stuff in January, lifted the ban, did more liquidity, yeah, we're going to get a pop. Economic activity is going to pick up a bit. But ultimately, at some point, all these rate hikes, the QT, everything else that's going on is still going to come home to roost on the economy. So I don't think we escape that entirely. It just may soften the blow a little bit.
Okay, great. All right. So now on the recession watch side of things, I'm just going to pull up one headline here, which is an article from Mohammed El-Erian, who is mm-hmm. one of the, I would say, more respected economists in the U.S. these days. And he is on Team Recession, Lance. and he says, it's not just going to be your ordinary garden variety recession. It's going to be, quote, a profound economic and financial shift. He says that it's going to be unlike the recessions that we're used to, that we should brace for, quote, violent shocks that may reshape the global economy forever. So I'm just going to read one paragraph from the article itself. Three new trends in particular hint at such a transformation and are likely to play an important role in shaping economic outcomes over the next few years. Number one is the shift from insufficient demand to insufficient supply as a major multi-year drag on growth. So he sees sort of persisting supply chain issues. Second, the end of boundless liquidity from central bank, the increasing fragility of financial markets. So this is all from an op-ed that El-Erian wrote in Foreign Affairs. You know, Mohammed El-Erian's not a guy who's prone to hyperbole. And so reading this, I was just sort of like, wow, okay. Like, you know, this is a notable milestone here where you get a conventional and highly respected economist like this, who also lives in the real world. I mean, he's managed a bunch of funds. So he's not just a guy who spouts opinions. He usually has to put capital behind what he's saying, who's basically saying, you know, kind of picking up on Jamie Dimon's economic hurricane type of, what do you want to call that? I'm blanking on the word I'm trying to come up with here, obviously, but not histrionic, but, you know, he's putting a lot of emotion into the warnings here. For him to kind of be that overt is, it's eye-opening at least. So what are your thoughts?
you know, I don't disagree with him. You know, he's a very smart guy. And, you know, there's a couple of things I'll look at that, you know, are important. I do think that we're going to have a recession next year. The depth of the recession is going to depend a lot on the Fed. So if, now he's right. If the Fed continues to hike rates and do QT at $95 billion a month and doesn't stop it, even when you're in a recession and the recession sets in, it's going to be pretty bad. I mean, you're just causing a snowball effect. Supply chains are coming back online. You know, we're talking about, you know, companies having to downshift in terms of, you know, FedEx laying off workers because, you know, we're seeing a downshift in demand. At the same time, we've got Walmart, Target, Best Buy, and others. By the way, this is a Friday interview. I don't know why you're watching this. You're supposed to be shopping. Yeah. But, you know, right now, this is time to get great deals on stuff, right? Because these inventories have to get liquidated. So there are some areas of the economy, I agree with him, that still have supply chain disruptions, but there's a lot of other areas where we're starting to see an abundance of supply, inventory to sales ratios, et cetera, starting to get back to pre-pandemic levels as things are starting, as demand falls and supply is catching up. So again, remember, we don't have to get all the way back to where we were supply-wise if demand falls enough, right? There's just a balance that we're going to get.
Exactly. And the Fed and other central banks are except for the People's Bank of China, are working hard to bring that demand down right now. So, my guess is I didn't read the full foreign affairs piece. And I think like you, Lance, which is, hey, I think we're going to have more excess liquidity, at least in the near term, in a lot of things. My daughter's in the market for a car and I'm telling her to wait. And we've talked about this before, right? My guess is maybe he's just thinking of sort of this transition to friendshoring, you know, which is, and still the redrawing of global trade in the wake of the Russian boycott and stuff like that, where it's probably going to take years, you know, overall for all that stuff to be reworked out. So the interim is just going to be messy, is my guess.
No, I agree. And look, in this, but here goes back to, you know, the thesis, right? I'm not as smart as Muhammad Al-Aryan, you know, never, you know, not even near his ballpark. So I'm not going to argue with him at all. But, you know, as we go into next year, I think there's a real possibility that we have a recession. I think there's too many factors, too much in the wake of, you know, interest rates that haven't come through yet, inflation that's still weighing on consumers, lack of liquidity for consumers. I think there's just too many signs that you're going to have a recession. So a recession is one thing. What he's talking about, and really what I think the one-off risk is next year, is what you and I have talked about for months now, which has been the Fed breaks something.
Right.
And generally, that'll be something in the credit market or something that all of a sudden leads to a very fast collapse in economic activity, deflationary trends, a collapse in stock market prices. Now, I'm just slow your roll here. I'm not talking about the end of the universe and you need to be in a bunker with your gold bullion. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, you know, this is where we get that 30% drop off in equity markets in a couple of weeks. And it's kind of a shock event, and we have to go through that cycle. I still think that's a risk that a lot of people aren't factoring in. And so that's something. So there's, you know, if we had to put stuff in a bucket, in fact, Mike and I are working on a grid right now of potential outcomes for next year. And so you have the soft landing scenario, you've got the mild recession scenario, you've got the, you know, you've got the deep recession scenario, you've got the crash scenario, right? So we're you know, creating this kind of organizational chart of, you know, of these different outcomes and what portfolio strategy should look like relative to these various outcomes. So as these things start to mature and we start to see them develop, we kind of already have a game plan together of, okay, this is what we need to do. So, you know, I certainly don't think you can discount what Muhammad Al-Aryan is saying entirely. It's a really bad outcome if it happens. And I think the Fed will be coming to that rescue if we get there.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Which I know that, and you've been consistent on that, saying, hey, Powell said, look, we're going to hike. We're going to pause. We're going to stay at this level for a long time.
No,
and you said in the past, I don't think so. Something's going to break and they're going to be forced to intervene. So you're being consistent there.
Yeah.
All right.
Look, in all fairness, I could be wrong. So.
Yeah.
Maybe we can survive with 8% mortgages and 5.5% Fed funds rate with $93 trillion in debt. Sure. It's possible.
Well, we'll see. And folks, whatever does happen, we will be tracking it here every week on this program. So hopefully you won't be surprised by it. It just kind of on a theme of things breaking, it's probably still too early to really see the evidence yet. But you know, we've been following the meltdown at FTX very closely. And I think at this point, they're admitting there are now millions of creditors. Right now, a lot of them are small people that, you know, had funds or owned FTT tokens or whatever, or had funds in FTX. But there are some really big players that are out a lot of money. I think like the top 10 or something like that are out over $3 billion worth, or might even be a little bit more than that. And they've petitioned to remain anonymous for the time being. And I totally get why. If you're a bank that's having trouble, you don't want the world to know, because then there's going to be a bank run on you, right? But we do know a lot of the firms that had exposure to FTX. And a lot of them are pretty big firms. You know, Sequoia Capital is one of them. We talked about them a lot last time. And there's a lot of companies out there that had exposure that I don't think have as deep pockets as guys like Sequoia Capital do. So it seems to me that we're going to start hearing pretty soon of at least the first wave of these companies where funds are saying, hey, you know what? I was trying to work out a rescue, but I couldn't. But yeah, I ended up being way too exposed to these guys, and we're going under, folks, right? And then you begin to have the contagion risk of, well, okay, well, who was invested in that fund? And you know, right? So you can get the domino effect going from there.
Well, there's another risk, right? And that's just people going, you know what? I'm out. And that too, that's the run on the bank issue, right? They just kind of lose faith in, you know, Coinbase is a good example of this.
Right.
You know, their bonds are trading at roughly 50 cents on the dollar now, which is, now that's not the end of the world, but that's starting to tell you there's bankruptcy risk rising with Coinbase. Now, the problem with Coinbase is that customer deposits are the collateral for the company.
Right.
So if they go
Coinbase goes under, yeah.
Yeah. Your deposits are gone because they will be used to shore up, you know, the debt of the company. So really the smart play with Coinbase is to buy their bonds right now.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting. So, you know, we were talking, I think it was last week, that, you know, I think a lot of crypto people are waking up to the fact that, hey, if you want the Wild West in terms of unbounded opportunities and unfettered, you know, from regulators and control and stuff like that, you have to take the other side of the coin, which is that the Wild West, you know, there are little to no rules. And when things go sideways, there's no one there to help you out, right? And that's what's going on right now. And my assumption is that the crypto space is going to get hit a lot harder from this. The losses are going to be biggest there from what's going on in FTX than the non-crypto space. But I'm increasingly looking for and worried that the contagion is going to spill out into the non-crypto space, where you have players that were heavily invested in FTX or some of its, you know, subsidiaries, who all of a sudden go under, and then somebody who is not thinking that they have exposure to FTX says, oh gosh, but I do have exposure to that fund that just went under, right? How material does your gut tell you this could be right now?
My gut says it's not a huge risk because FTX isn't that big. And again, you sit there and go, well, it's $8 billion, Lance. It's $8 billion. You got to remember, we throw around $1 billion like left pocket change on the markets today. You know, so if it doesn't have a T following it, you know, it's not even rising to right now, FTX isn't even rising to the risk level that the Federal Reserve has even mentioned it at this point. You know, the Federal Reserve hasn't come out in one of their meetings, or Jerome Powell, by the way, speaks next week. So if Jerome Powell comes out and says, hey, we're monitoring the situation with FTX, excuse me, then that's a good nomer that there's probably more substantial, to your point, Adam, that there's some spreading risk in the economy. Right now, you've heard nothing. And you know, FTX is big. Don't get me wrong. I mean, losing $8 billion worth of people's money, that's significant, right? I mean, there's people that, and it's sad because there's a lot of these younger millennial investors and Gen Zers and whoever from, you know, that have never been through a bear market. They had all their life savings into this stuff because they were like, oh, this is the next thing to be in. It's going to be great and wonderful. I'm going to make billions of dollars. And they've lost it all now. And there's probably not going to be a lot of recovery, unfortunately. I'm hoping so. I'm hoping they find a pot of money, can get people some of their money back.
Yeah, not happening right now. We're hearing the exact opposite, that they keep finding more is lost or stolen.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. But back to our conversation, I don't know if it's big enough to cause a contagion in the markets. And again, the one thing that we're really talking about, when we talk about a financial crisis, we talk about the Fed breaking something, we're talking about credit. Credit is the blood of the economy. It can come and go, right? But the credit market, when you freeze up the credit market, nobody wants to trade. If nobody wants to buy or sell your debt, this market's done. That's what happened back in 2008. So, you know, we could have a long-term capital situation where the Fed comes and bails out something, but it could be, you know, inconsequential to the stock market as a whole. You get something on credit side, that's going to be a much different
story. That'll be much more. Okay, great. All right. Good points. All right. Well, look, I think, and I'm trying to engineer this, I think we may end earlier today than we have for our past few marathon sessions. That said, I still have a couple of topics I want to go through, as well as a few things, a few opportunities, resources to flag for folks. And one of them is getting to any trades you guys did this week, Lance. We'll get to that in just a second. First, I just want to pick up on a thread from some of our past recent videos about the labor market. I think both you and I, you know, have been waving the flag that we think that recession's ahead, and with recession will come material job layoffs, right? So we've been trying to get people to prepare for the potential that could happen to them and take, you know, preparatory steps now to reduce their vulnerability. There are still, you know, the recession hits keep on coming. This week, Google just announced that they're going to fire or lay off 6% of the company. That's around another 10,000 people. So it seems to be the popular thing to do right now in the Silicon Valley world is just cut 10,000 from your ranks. Again, I still believe that these are the early easy cuts, and much harder and probably more painful and bigger ones are to come. But last week when we were talking, I mentioned a comment that I sort of floated out there on Twitter, which got a lot of debate, which was that if there's a lot of people that are saying that, okay, you know, Elon Musk, he fired half of Twitter, and then he basically forced the rest of the company to sign a pledge that said, look, we're in the fight of our lives. So if you sign this pledge, you're signing up for extraordinary commitment, you know, for the foreseeable future, or you might have to work some nights, some weekends, that type of stuff, right? And a good chunk of the company apparently resigned over that, refused to sign it, right? So he's down, I'm making a guesstimate here, but maybe 75% of the workforce is gone from where what was there a month ago when he took over the company, right?
And by the way, I just want to say that was a genius move on his part.
Well, it very well may turn out to be, right? But there's a lot of people that
think about this, right? So I can come in, I can lay off people, right? That's not a big lawsuit problem, right? I'm downsizing, I'm a private company, I can lay off employees. Yep. And that's okay. But now what I want to find out is who's committed to this project,
right?
So I signed this letter. Now think about this. If I'm working for Twitter and I'm really committed to making Twitter work, I'm probably already working 70 or 80 hours a week. I'm already dedicated to the job. I don't need you to have me sign a letter. So I send out this letter that says, hey, I need you to actually commit to the company and we're going to make this thing great again, right? And everybody says, well, I'm out. Those aren't the employees you want anyway. So I applaud Elon Musk. That was a genius move.
And when new hires come in, they know the culture that they're self-selecting for, right? Exactly. So you're bringing in the exact type of people you want. So you're going kind of where I want to go with this. So my comment had been, look, if Twitter's around in 6 months and operating relatively smoothly, right? If it's not in just complete, you know, meltdown mode, then that's going to send a really strong signal to the other companies in big tech that, hey, we need to take a fresh look at what we define as an essential employee here. Because if those guys just got rid of, you know, 75-ish% of their headcount, brought their employee costs down by 50 to 75%, and they're still operating and seem to be doing well, then yeah, maybe we've got some erroneous assumptions here and that, you know, they may follow suit with big layoffs of their own, right? So TBD if that's going to happen. I got a fair amount of pushback from some people saying, oh, Adam, you don't know software at all. I felt really validated. I was listening we took my daughter down to a college tour the other day, and I was listening to the All In podcast, which has Chamath Palihapitiya. I can never remember how to pronounce his last name, but he was a big investor, but he made a lot of his money in Facebook. David Friedberg, who made a ton of money from Google. Pardon me?
And he made a bunch of bombs with SPACs last year.
He made a bunch of bombs, but he's still more richer than most people alive.
He's doing just fine.
He's doing fine. You had David Friedberg, who worked at, made a ton of money at Google. You had David Sachs. I'm forgetting what company he made a ton of money from. But basically, these are Silicon Valley insiders, right? And they talked about this exact same topic. And they made the exact same points that I made and that you just made here, Lance. So it's nice to get some validation there from folks that truly live and breathe that industry, that that what's going on there right now is a really interesting and I think potentially really significant experiment. And when the results are known, you know, it could have some real shockwaves. And not, I think not just in big tech, but potentially across a ton of companies, right? Yeah. If people say, whoa, wait a minute, you know, maybe there's a lot more, you know, dead weight, I hate to use that term, to cut here. But my underlying point here is that if that indeed does happen, you and I think we're already going to have pretty substantial layoffs anyways, just because of where the economy is going. This may layer on top of that and take an entirely new subset that would have otherwise not been fired or laid off and may add them in this time around. So these could be really substantial layoffs that we're looking at.
You know, and look, and you know, it's very iffy whether or not Twitter makes it over the next 6 months, and not from the standpoint of just, you know, he can't run the company. It's not gonna be that at all. I mean, he needs advertising dollars. And, you know, if these kind of more liberal woke ideologies, you know, drive off enough of the advertisers that support the platform, you know, he could effectively, I mean, there's a risk that he could, you know, go into bankruptcy. I mean,
that's been one of the questions about Twitter all along is there a sustainable business model for Twitter? Forget about woke ideology and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So that's still TBD. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, but, you know, if he can, you know, get the company organized, get it back to functioning and operating normally, set out a very clear, defined business path that he's on. And then, you know, I think once you get to that structure, advertisers will come back, he'll grow the company. And I think he'll be fine. I think he way overpaid for it. I don't think he ever gets his money back on it. But, you know, we can get to a valuation argument, some of that. He's going to have to take the company back public at some point to get his money back. But I think he's got a platform for it. And you know, if there's any guy that can do this, I mean, he's done wonders with Tesla and SpaceX. So I'm not going to put anything past him.
He's the kind of guy you've learned not to bet against. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, but I want to connect this with one other development that's just happened in the news, which is the new prime minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni.
Yeah.
She just announced another round
of applause for her.
Okay. Yeah. So she just announced that Italy will revoke social benefits for those who are receiving, you know, basically social welfare or whatever from the government who refuse job offers. Right. So it's very much kind of a use it or lose it. Right. Like, hey, you know, we have this in place as a safety net, but it's not a permanent one. Right. And if it's there to bridge you from, you know, your periods of unemployment, but you have to be out there looking for work. And if you get it, you have to take it. Right. This isn't an eternal check here. Right. And I mentioned this because this is a point I've been trying to make recently, which is, you know, once you get into a recession, all of the sort of niceties, you know, in life, it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You just start abandoning everything at the top on your way down, depending upon how bad that recession is. And because you and I have talked about a lot of different reasons, and other people on this channel have, you know, also weighed in on this, and Jim Rogers just gave his yesterday, it's going to be the worst recession of his lifetime, right? You know, a lot of these, societal entitlements, whatever you want to call them, they begin to get chucked out the window just the same way that if you're in a hot air balloon and it springs a leak and it starts plummeting, you're throwing everything out of that balloon in the hopes to try to stabilize your altitude, right? And there's a lot of things that I just think people, you know, they've gotten used to, or they think we deserve, or they think it's not a privilege, it's a right or whatever. And what I'm just trying to warn people about is your employer, they're going to say all the right things right up until the point, you know, they realize they need to make further cuts to stay alive. And once they come to that realization, nothing they told you before matters anymore.
Yeah, no, there was to your point, there was I forget the name of the company, like WeFox or something like this. It's a European tech company. And he came out on Friday and said that these layoffs by tech companies, those are just, you know, terrible. These tech companies have a responsibility to these employees. They shouldn't be laying off workers, et cetera. And what's interesting is that, you know, we have gotten to the point in society, and again, I talked about kind of the, you know, a lot of these advertisers that took on this whole kind of liberal woke ideology at Twitter and said, okay, we're not going to advertise at Twitter because they're undermining democracy and all this stuff. That is so much crap, right? I mean, you know, when you take a look at what, you know, and what kind of defines the difference between conservatism and, you know, being a Democrat as an example, you know, this isn't, you know, evil policies on one side and great policy, you know, angelistic policies on the other side. And the Democrats, you know, don't control all the good policies, and then the conservatives all have the evil policies. You know, what conservatism is doing things that promote strong economic growth and stability of the economy and constitutionalism, these type of things. And what Maloney's doing is doing exactly what you should do to have a strong economic environment. In order to have a strong economy, you need people working, not living off government subsidies. But that's the ideology that we've taken on here in America, that we need to have more social welfare and we need to have more, you know, benefits. California has been doing all kinds of new checks now for helping out the transgender population. They're now going to get a net income coming into them just for being transgender. That's fine, but you're not really helping anybody, right? Because all you're doing is recycling tax dollars. If you want to create a stronger environment, you want to create stronger economic growth, you know, this is where you talk about reducing your deficit, you know, living within your means, having a budget, you know, all those, these are those evil right-wing conservative ideas that, you know, that apparently is a destruction of democracy, of wanting things to be more fundamentally structured within an economy so that it will grow. And I think this is the part, Adam, that we've got to start, you know, kind of figuring our way how to get back to, is like, leave all this party politics crap to the sides and say, what's good for economic growth? And what's good for economic growth isn't what's popular. Unfortunately, it's not free checks. It's not welfare. It's not all these other, you know, gimmies, free college, you know, that's not what promotes anything that is better for an economy. We need people to work to produce, you know, live within their means and live within the law, right? And if you have that, you wind up with a strong economy going forward.
Right. And you and I have talked in the past, relatively recently, about the boom bust cycle. And for whatever reason, we have gotten to the point where, like a petulant child, we just don't want the bust anymore. We just want rainbows and unicorns and ice cream every day. Right. And austerity is a key part of the bust cycle. Right. Let's let the malinvestment flush out. And when it does, we're better off for it because we're laying the foundation for the next boom. Right. So you have to embrace it. We just are desperately trying not to, right? That's been the problem. And one of the reasons why I'm, again, beating this horse as much as I am is, if you're a younger person watching this, and by younger, I mean sort of Gen Z or younger millennial, or if you have children that are in that age, they haven't lived through, really, at least as a professional, you know, a recession, a bad recession, or even almost any recession. Yes, we had one in 2020, but it was very, very quick, right? And so they just don't have the lived experience to kind of know what's coming. Also, I think that generation, because of the big boom we've had, you know, they've had bargaining power, a certain amount of bargaining power with employers, where they've said, look, you know, what's important to our generation is, you know, we need to have, you know, flexibility in our working hours. We need to have, you know, it's just sort of special accommodations on the work environment that are important to us as a generation, right? And, you know, part of that comes with, you know, safe spaces and the right to be free from microaggressions and stuff like that. I'm not trying to beat too much on these generations, but I'm just trying to say that, like all of that stuff gets immediately cut when times get tight, right? And so if you're expecting your employer to kind of continue to honor that type of contract that they've begun to be striking with these younger generations, you're totally setting yourself up for disappointment if we go into the type of recession that we're talking about here. And that's really the light bulb I'm trying to turn on in people's minds here.
Yeah, what you need, what you think you need, and what you want are two totally different things. You know, what you need is a paycheck. And when you work for a paycheck, and then look, this is the difference between working for yourself. If you want to work for yourself and own your own company, you can have your own safe spaces, whatever you want, right? But when you work for somebody else, you're all, I was actually having this talk with my daughter last night. She's in from college and we're talking about her, you know, her next semester, and she's taking 19 hours and it's going to be very hard on her because it's just a very heavy load. But, you know, we were having this conversation, you know, when you get out of, you know, job, right? I mean, you're going to be doing all the grunt work because you've got no experience. And so don't go into this company thinking you're going to have a corner office somewhere with a secretary. And that ain't going to be it. You're going to be dealing with a bunch of old assholes that are going to yell at you, and they're going to be mean to you, and they're going to, you know, tell you to be at work on time. And if you don't be at work on time, they're going to yell at you for not doing that. And, you know, you're going to get your feelings hurt. But guess what? That's just part of it. And she was like in shock, almost in tears, that I'm telling you this. And you know, but the problem is that they just don't have any realization that, you know, this is what's coming, and they're just really ill prepared for it.
Yeah. Well, again, and that's why I'm really beating the horse like this in these videos. And it is really simple. It's simple. I was explaining this to somebody the other day, which is, look, when you're in the throes of a recession, the transaction becomes really simple. All the employer wants is the employee to deliver enough value to help the company stay afloat. And usually the core measure of that is cash flow positive, right? If you can just keep me from falling under the water, great. You got a place here, right? And for the employee, it's really, hey, times are really bad. I just want to be able to make rent, be able to feed myself, and not go into debt, right? And it becomes very transactive there. And in some ways, it's almost sort of refreshing where everybody knows where everybody stands. And it's very much like, are you doing what you need to do? And if you are, great, right? And we're hopefully all going to get through this together. That is a very different relationship than what most people have right now with their employers. And as you were just saying there, Lance, you know, for a lot of them, it's going to hit them across the head like a 2x4, especially if they haven't been through this before, and they're coming at it with no, I deserve all of these, you know, privileges, benefits, you know, whatever, because that's the contract we have with each other, right? And right. It's sort of like, no, you know, our job is to keep this company alive so it can pay you, and if either one of us can't do that, we're, you know, you're gone or my company's dead,
right? And that goes back to Elon Musk and his statement, right? Sign this document that you're going to commit the time to make this company successful, otherwise please leave, because I need to put somebody in your seat that will commit the time and the effort and the energy to make this company successful. So, you know, again, I think it was genius the way he did it. I mean, he had a whole bunch of people call themselves out of the company, and it immediately tells you, like, okay, well, those, I thought Jim over there, I thought he was going to be a good one, right? And he's got a good skill set, but, you know, he's not out the door. So obviously, you know, he's not the guy I wanted for that job. So, and look, great opportunity. If you know how to code, Twitter's got job openings.
Yeah, they're hiring. Yeah, exactly. They're hiring. And part of the brilliance there too is, you know, if he had just stepped in and randomly fired more people, there's, you know, the increasing odds of opening himself up to some sort of lawsuit of, hey, it was an unfair termination for whatever. This was a, hey, you have a chance to stay, right? You just signed the pledge and you're here, right? So it reduced his, part of the genius of the decision. All right, Lance, and hey, before we get to the next section here, let me just ask, what trades, if any, did you guys make this week?
Just again, you know, as I was saying earlier in the show, you know, we talked about using this rally to sell into, and we've been talking about doing that over the last, you know, couple of weeks. This week was just more of that. We trimmed back our energy exposure a bit in our portfolio because, again, as I said, energy stocks have declined about 5%. Oil prices are down about 20%. So there's going to be some catch up there. Again, also concerned about that portfolio rebalancing at the beginning of December for mutual funds may lead to some more selling pressure on energy stocks. So just reduced those a bit. Still own them, right? Didn't sell them all. Just took a little bit of profit out of them. We also reduced our position in preferred equities. The reason is they have a bit of an equity bias to them. They have higher yields, but we need a little bit of a tax loss harvest. They were down very minutely. So we just went ahead and sold them for now. We'll buy them back next year when the yield curve uninverts. But that helped raise about 3% cash. So we've got our cash position or portfolio now north of 20%. Equity exposure is down close to 35, 36%, which is kind of where we want to be going into year end.
All right, great. Thanks. All right. Well, look, to end this on a positive note.
Yes.
At the end of last week, we talked about how we were going to punt to this week. The discussion about the Johnson O'Connor aptitude test specifically, but really more about the value of investing in oneself, right? And this is a particularly valuable conversation for younger viewers or people who have children or young adult children. But honestly, what I'm going to tell you applies to everybody, and I'll make that clear in just a moment here. This is a topic that's it's really close to my heart. It's been a passion of mine for a long time. I actually wrote a book about it. I'm a little embarrassed to show folks the book just because it was never intended to really be a book. I wrote it as like a downloadable PDF, and it got long enough that I said, you know, let me figure out what this whole self-publishing thing is about. And I just put it up on Amazon through their self-publishing process just to learn the process. But anyways, this book's called Finding Your Way to Your Authentic Career. I'm not pushing the book, but I'm just letting you know that I've got some background in this area. And the question that sort of fascinates me is what should I do with my life, right? I mean, every young person asks themselves, most adults still ask themselves at every age, right? It's a hard, easy question to ask, hard question to figure out. And as you and I have talked about, Lance, our education system does a particularly poor job. It just fails completely in most cases in helping people answer that question. What it does is it throws a lot of information at you, and it just makes the assumption that by the time graduation comes up, the light bulb has gone off in your head, the clouds have parted, the sunbeam has come down on you, and you've figured out what to do with yourself. Well, that happens to a very small percentage of students. Instead, you get to graduation, you really don't know what you want to do. And especially when you're younger, you just sort of follow the influences in your life. Your parents are telling you, well, hey, we think you should do X, or this is what your peers are doing, right? Or especially when you're graduating college and you don't know what to do with your life, a lot of times it's just determined by what companies are hiring in that business cycle that show up on campus, right? And so you kind of just find yourself sort of shuffling along this path. And invariably, what that tends to result in is people wake up, you know, 10 years down the road and say, all right, I'm in a cubicle doing this. And is this what I'm going to do the rest of my life? This is not what I want to be doing, right? If I could do a do-over, maybe I still don't know what I would do, but I know it's sure not going to be this, right? Yeah. But you tend to be trapped because at this point you might have a mortgage or kid or whatnot. And so a lot of people just feel sort of chained to their daily career existence and feel like they can't get out of it, right? I'm here to tell you that there is a progression of tests and exercises that if you follow, just like following a workout training regime, Lance, it's going to answer that question for you, or it's going to get you close enough that with some additional iteration, you'll be able to answer it, or at least come up with an answer that's much better than where you are right now. And it's all about, you know, data, right? The problem is we don't teach this in school. And it's also like working out where you have to have the discipline to go through this process. And it takes some commitment and it's not super easy. You got to do some real work, self-sacrifice. But if you do it, it will get you the answer that you're looking for and in many ways be transformative for putting you in a place professionally where you're playing to your interests, you're succeeding a lot more, and you just have purpose, and you enjoy your days when you wake up to do them. So anyways, long story short, I tell people who don't read the book, I say, look, if you only remember one thing, look into the Johnson O'Connor aptitudes test. Of all the tests that are out there, this is the one that I think makes the biggest difference in terms of giving you really actionable insights. And they also are insights that will not change for the rest of your life. And as I mentioned in 2 weeks ago, I finally had my younger daughter go take this. I've been waiting her whole life for her to take it because you can't take it until you're at least 15. Well, she just turned 16. She raised her hand and said, Dad, I'm interested in this now. So she went and did it. It's a 6-hour training testing program. They probably give you 30 plus tests. Most of them are not written. A lot of these things are very practical. So we just had her results read out where you get an hour with a researcher who really digs into these things with you. And what's great about it is it tells you, here are your scores, and yes, these are the industries, and this is the type of work that you are aligned for given your scores. But more importantly, it just helps you understand what's important to you in terms of how you're wired, what you're unnaturally good at, and what things you're not so good at, right? And then you can use those as compass points to navigate the rest of your life by. Like, it's not necessarily going to give you the answer, but it's going to give you the navigation orientation to chart your way to the answer, is the way that I mention it. So she ended up getting her results. I thought they were very useful because in some ways they validated some parts of her that I think she knew about herself, and some other parts it really opened her eyes to other elements herself she never thought of, right? And so it is going to, just like it did for me when I took it 12 years ago, I think it's going to really help her have a lot more confidence in terms of where she's going to be looking for work, the type of work she's going to do, and where she's going to look to do it, because she now can have confidence in these key areas of herself. And just to give you guys a real quick sense of you know, what they came back with her, the thing she scored highest on was problem solving. And, you know, she's not a super STEM-y person. It's not like, oh, you're, you know, a math genius and we're going to throw math problems at you all day long. It's just that she's the type of person who, hey, if there's a goal, I'm going to help figure out how to get to that goal. One of the key things coming out of this process is, which I hope this will serve her the rest of her life, is they said, look, you are a natural problem solver, and you're going to do that no matter what you're doing for a living, right? And the danger with somebody like you is that people are going to realize you're a good problem solver, and they're going to want to drag you into solving their problems, right? So what you need to do early in your life is ask yourself, what problems do I enjoy solving? And put yourself in a place to be solving those types of problems, because then you're going to be excited, you're going to be motivated, you're going to like what you do. And I thought that was just such a great way to frame it for somebody who's wired like her, which is, okay, that's going to be an insight that's going to guide, I think, the rest of her life. When she's, you know, in the middle of a project or being asked to sign up for one, she can take a beat and say, okay, wait a second, I might be able to do this well, but is this the type of thing that actually really feeds and engages me? And if not, hey, thanks for the job offer, I'm going to turn it down. Or, hey, yeah, maybe I'll do this project for a short bit of time, but I'm telling you now, I'm not going to let myself get locked into this for the next 6 months, because it's just not the type of work I want to be doing. If folks want to learn more about the Johnson O'Connor test, Lance, I could literally talk about it for an entire podcast, and maybe someday will. I did record an interview with the executive director of this program five plus, probably more years back. If you want to learn more about the actual test itself and what it tests for, what you can do with the results, just go to wealthion.com/Johnson O'Connor, and you can listen to that entire interview. And, you know, if it's something you're interested in, you can go learn more about actually how to take the test and where to take it. But the key thing I want to leave folks with here is, like I said, there's a progression of this is just one test. There's a progression of these types of tests, as well as personal exercises you can do, that give you a full picture, a much more full picture of who you are, you know, what type of work environment suits you well, you know, obviously given your personality, what you know would be a good fit for you in terms of, you know, how you want to approach your work or who you want to work with, goal setting, you know, your strengths, your weaknesses, your passions. These are all the things that our school system does not teach you. And so you've got to do the education yourself. And most people have said, oh, yeah, I took a test, you know, somewhere in high school. You know, a lot of people have taken, say, the Myers-Briggs personality test, right? It's useful information. It's not going to tell you what to do with your life if you've learned that you're an introvert, right? But it does give you, you know, some perspective into how to, you know, determine whether a particular opportunity is a good fit for you or not. And the way that I liken all this for people to really try to help them understand it is, if you think of the old TV screens we used to have in the old TVs, they were these lines of pixels, these vertical lines of pixels. And if you see a vertical line of pixels just by itself, you don't know what it represents. It's just a vertical line. But if you see a whole bunch of these vertical lines of pixels next to each other pushed together, well, then you have a full picture, right? That's what's showing you, you know, what's going on. That's what I think these, you know, self-discovery exams and exercises offer the individual. And, you know, once you have it, it's, you can use it as your, like I said, your navigation tool for making all your decisions later on in life. And one thing about this Johnson O'Connor test, if you take it in your late teens before you go to college, your rate of switching majors drops by 70% because you're making such a better fit decision earlier in your life. And just imagine, Lance, think of all the bad decisions you and I have made across the span of our lives, right? If we could have reduced that by 20% or 30%, that would have been one of the most valuable investments we ever could have made of our times. And so I'll stop my gushing here, but the point is honestly, this type of self-discovery and self-understanding is one of the most valuable investments that you can make. And just like a financial investment, the earlier you can make it in life, the greater the return as you amortize it over more and more years and bigger decisions of your life. And so, folks, if you're a younger person hearing this, definitely think about investing in this. If you're a parent who's got, you know, kids, I think in my mind, this is part of your role as a parent is to shepherd them into opportunities to learn these types of things about themselves. And honestly, I mean, I took the Johnson O'Connor test and most of what I put in this book here, I went through that process when I was 40, right? And still, you know, I would not be doing, let me put it this way. If I hadn't gone through that process, Wealthion wouldn't exist today. At least if it did, somebody else would have done it. It wouldn't have been me. I wouldn't have found my way here. It was only by garnering that self-understanding that I was able to kind of get off what was a good, quote unquote, good career track, right? I was VP of marketing at Yahoo. Great job in many people's eyes, just not the right trajectory for me. And I ended up moving off to something that was totally unknown, super high risk, starting something from scratch that really didn't exist. And I never would have done that unless I had gotten all that information. And when I finally looked at all my options, said, wow, this totally non-traditional high risky thing, even though I'm a low risk person, is like custom designed for me. And it gave me the confidence to go do it. And fortunately, we are where we are today. So anyways, I'll shut up here now, Lance, but I know that this is something you're interested in too. So I'm curious to hear any input you have.
No, absolutely. Look, I mean, this is the, in fact, I talked to my daughter who's just turned 16 about the test as well. And so she's mulling it over, right? So it's just like, God, 6 hours of my life, Dad.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, but you know, it's worth it. And, you know, she goes, she's, you know, and the reason is that she's trying to figure out what school she wants to go to. And she's, you know, trying to figure out what her degree path is going to be and those type of things. We have these conversations, you know, all the time. And, you know, but no, anything that can give somebody a bit of direction. I know, like for myself, you know, when I went, I told my daughter this. So when I went to college, all I wanted to do when I came out of college, I remember I went to college back in the 80s, right? Early 80s. But when I went to college, all I wanted to do is graduate and go work for Coca-Cola as a middle manager. That was my life goal, right? Because my dad had worked for Dow Chemical his whole life. And I was taught growing up, that's what you do. You go work for a big company, you work your way up into management, you get your pension, you know, whatever it is, you do your 30 and you're out, right? And that's and that was the mentality I was raised into. But that's not really for me because I'm a risk taker. I like creating things, I like doing that. So if I'd had this test available to me back then, I would have probably bypassed, and to your point, done a lot of things differently and gotten to where I am now sooner.
Yeah, well, all right. So, you know, look, all of us old dogs watching this, you know, we've got, you know, the would-haves and could-haves and should-haves. But like I said, I mean, honestly, if I hadn't, I would take it now at 51, because what it would do is it would, even if I were happy in the path that I was in, it would give me insights that would help me optimize the path that I was in. And obviously, if I'm in a place that's not a good fit for me, it would give me insight into, you know, where to go elsewhere from here. So anyways, been violent agreement. This is one of the best investments that you can make. All right. So folks, we'll start wrapping up here. I do want to talk about one other small investment, which is if you've been watching Wealthion for over a year, you may remember last holiday season, Gina Love, who is the CEO of a company called Auvers. It's a jewelry company that shares investors with Wealthion. She very kindly reached out to me and just said, hey, I love your channel. I'd love to give your audience a discount to my product set. And the reason why I mentioned this on the program last year and why I'm doing it again now is they make jewelry out of precious metals, gold, silver, but they make it out of very, pure form. So gold, 22, 24 karat, silver, sterling silver. Kind of the theme there is, look, you know, everybody should own some precious metals for the, you know, just the financial safety part of it. But if you're going to own it, why not own it in a form that you're actually going to enjoy and get additional return out of by wearing and, you know, showing the world. And so she created a jewelry company around that. And also, you know, it was sort of like a Trojan horse way to get more people to own precious metals, right? So a lot of the clientele is coming and buying the jewels, the jewelry, because it's just really good looking. But of course, that is helping them achieve their mission of getting more and more people to own at least a little bit of precious metal just in case, right? And there's a lot of people watching this program who have certainly had the challenge, at least I hear your stories and have experienced myself this at times firsthand, of wanting to buy precious metals as a conservative investment, but maybe your spouse or your significant other really isn't quite on board with that. And they just are saying, hey, that's just a waste of money. I'd rather be doing something else with that money. That conversation goes really differently when you say, hey, honey, here's, you know, some jewelry I just bought you. That tends to be much more well received, right?
That works out every time.
I'm not sure if there's a time where that doesn't work out well. Exactly. Anyways, you know, folks, this is not the cheapest way to buy gold and silver, you know, making very clear about that. You're paying for the design on top of, you know, the actual value of the metal itself. But it has the benefits that we talked about here. So if this is something you're interested in, the company is Auvert.com. I'll put up a visual here of some of their best-selling jewelry. And if you're interested, go onto their website. And if you find something you like, Auvert is offering Wealthy On viewers 15% off of all full-priced 22 and 24 karat gold jewelry and all full-priced sterling silver jewelry. And to get that 15% discount, you just enter AUWealth15 upon checkout. All right. So hopefully that's fun for folks. Big thanks to Gina to offering that. Again, I got some very nice emails from folks last year who bought this for their significant others who were very pleased by it. All right. And in wrapping up here, Lance, I guess real quick, let me give you a chance to have the last word on just anything we talked about this week. You know, it is it's a week for gratitude. Again, we just finished Thanksgiving. Again, thank you as well. Let me just express my gratitude for you, Lance, for being being willing to give so much of your time to this channel by coming on week after week to have these extremely long conversations with me, but also for all the work that you and the team at RIA, Real Investment Advisors, do every day for your clients, obviously, but also for all the folks that come to you from watching Wealthy On who are having those consultations and just looking for some good, you know, advice. And you guys do that totally free with no commitment that you're asking for. It's just a public service. That is a huge gift. And it helps me sleep really well at night knowing that I'm running this channel with you guys as a resource for folks.
No, and look, we're very thankful for you as well. I mean, you've given us a lot of fun doing this for sure. And again, you know, look, if you go to realinvestmentadvice.com, we've got a blog that we post every week and actually twice a week, three times a week, actually post a blog. It's free at the website. We post a weekly newsletter that's free, daily commentary that gives you market trading updates every day. So there's a ton of just free resources for everybody at realinvestmentadvice.com. So again, take advantage of it. That's what we publish it for. And if you're there and have a question, there's a box at the top. You just ask a question. Hey, I got a question about, you know, this or that or the other thing. I answer every email every day. So you'll get a response. So yeah, we're always happy to help.
All right. Well, guys, if you remember Lance's step number 7 on his how to prepare for a coming bear market article we talked about earlier, that was unless you feel 1,000% confident of your ability to navigate, you know, these markets right now and what's coming, consider working with the help of a professional financial advisor. If you've got a good one, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does understand all these macro risks, maybe even Lance and his team at RIA themselves, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. And again, totally free, no commitments, just a public service that's being offered. All right, last folks, hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Again, just immense gratitude from the bottom of my heart for your continued patronage and support of this channel. If you remember the chart I put up earlier, that is all 1,000% entirely due to your presence here on what we're doing. And hopefully We're going to take things to even greater and greater heights in 2023. Like I mentioned, I've got a lot of great things that we're working on, and you guys keep sending me great ideas every day, either in direct emails or in the comments below. So if you have any right now, please share them. I do read them all. But if you enjoy these weekly market recaps and what we're trying to accomplish here at Wealthion, please do Lance and I a favor by supporting this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And no matter what happens from here in the markets over the next week, Lance will be back on with me next week, trying to make sense as best we can of it for you. Lance, buddy, thanks so much again.
Yep, absolutely. See you next week.
All right, everybody else, thanks so much for watching.